Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I appreciate all of you joining us this weekend, as I think you all have noticed that this week was slower for us on the daily editorial front because we were attending the Beaver Creek Investment Conference, where we got the opportunity to meet with a lot of resource companies. So, because we're in meetings all week, also as a note for this weekend show, we are recording it the weekend before. So, we're not really talking about short-term market moves here. We're talking more big picture concepts, because I think it's also worthwhile to take a little step back and talk about some of the main factors that have driven markets, not so much on the day-to-day basis, but more on a longer-term basis. I'm excited to say that we are kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also founder and editor of The Book Report, which is now on Substack, which I will be posting a link to within this weekend show posting. So, Peter, I want to start off by talking big picture about inflation, because inflation has been first and foremost on investors' mind, economic commentators' minds, simply because of the fact that inflation skyrocketed over the last couple of years. And that's after decades of, let's just call it, muted inflation. The Fed and other central banks all have this 2% inflation target. And for the 2000s, even 2010 through 2020, we saw inflation right around 2%, if not lower. But then all of a sudden, we have seen inflation pick up. There's many different areas that we can talk about as to why inflation picked up, but I want to get your insights on this. What changed in the last just couple years to get inflation moving and to skyrocket inflation?
Well, it's important to break out inflation into its component parts to help us sort of dig deeper into it. We have to look at services inflation, and we have to look at goods inflation, since those are the two contributors. With respect to services inflation, which makes up about 60% of overall CPI, there was never anything transitory about services inflation. In the 20 years leading into COVID, so right before COVID hit, services inflation ex energy averaged 2.8% a year. So call it 3% persistent annual inflation. And in those 20 years, goods prices, core goods prices, averaged zero, up a little above one, below one, averaged zero. So it was that muted good side inflation that kept inflation overall in check. And then, of course, depending on where food and energy prices go, you get a mix of 1 to 2% type of inflation in the lead up to COVID. So what triggered this bout of inflation over the past couple of years is obviously you had goods price inflation that joined the persistent, as I said, services side of inflation. And we know that the fiscal side came together with the monetary side to create the fuel for cash going out the door to consumers that spent more money than the supply side of the economy was able to meet. Therefore, you get a spike in goods prices. Combine that with a continued rise in services that was juiced by a very sharp rise in rents that came on top of a 40% rise in home prices over 2 years, and you get the inflation that we've had. So now the question is, if you want me to stop there, I can stop there. But the question is do we just go back to the pre-COVID 1 to 2% inflation trend, or has something changed structurally, at least on the good side, that prevents us from going back so soon to zero price inflation? And are we just going to go back to 2.5 to 3% services inflation, or has something changed there as well in this post-COVID world?
Okay, we will get into that, but I do want to ask, look, easy money policies were around for over a decade, even before the COVID pandemic. Was the difference that the easy money went into individuals' bank accounts rather than large financial institutions?
Pretty much. that was really the difference. And also the and it was, when you look back at all the QE and zero rates post great financial crisis, a lot of that QE sort of ended up back at the Fed in bank reserves, wasn't necessarily unleashed into the economy. This time it was the Fed that essentially gave money to the US government that then of course spent it via those checks that you mentioned. But also a lot of companies got saved through PPP loans and employee retention tax credits and so on. So there was the largest being sent out both on the household and corporate level. But what enabled that was the Fed, of course, suppressing interest rates and sucking up a lot of that treasury supply that was used to finance all those handouts.
Now, Peter, what about deglobalization? That's also been a trend there where it seems like goods prices, to your point, they've gone up. So is deglobalization also to blame for this?
Well, not yet. And let's clarify deglobalization. It's not really deglobalization. It's just re-globalization in the sense of instead of having all your supply coming out of China, you will have some of your supply come out of China and the rest coming from Vietnam, or the rest coming from India. That's still globalization. Or maybe you'll shift shift some production to Mexico. That's not necessarily reshoring because it's not happening on your soil, but it's a re-globalization is how I would really put it. Now, of course, the U.S. with the government initiatives, they're trying to bring more production of chips and renewable type stuff like EVs and batteries in the U.S., but generally speaking, it's still cost prohibitive for most reshoring to take place in the U.S. So it's really just a reprioritizing of where you will get that supply. So that's why it's not really deglobalization. Now, over time, the more stuff that gets made in the U.S., to use them as an example, that's going to be more expensive. It's going to be dramatically more expensive to make chips in the U.S. than compared to Taiwan or other parts of Asia. So that's going to be more expensive. And you can be sure that it's going to be more expensive to produce cars. And yes, that is going to contribute to something more structural and why I argue that we're not going back anytime soon to that zero trend of core goods prices. That core goods prices can be going up 1, 2, 3% a year instead of zero. Now, that may not sound a lot, but you combine that with potentially persistent sticky services inflation and voila, you have potentially a 3 to 4% type inflation trend rather than 1 to 2.
Okay, so now let's look ahead. Like you said, there are so many expectations out there. I would say the majority of people are expecting inflation to stay higher, and that's going to keep the Fed, well, it's going to stop them from maybe cutting rates as quickly as, who knows, some people would like, maybe even the Fed would like. Now, will this stuff stick around? Is inflation sticking around, or do we go back to that environment pre-COVID?
So I think that inflation sticks around. We're definitely on the downside of that inflation spike. So we're going to see, particularly on the rental side, that will show up on services inflation. We'll see continued moderation. So the question really is not, you have the inflation jump, you have the come down now, and it's not just, okay, maybe we get a 2% handle by the end of the year, early next year. It's where does it stay out? Where is the sustainable rate of inflation over the next couple of years? And, you know, as I said, I think it's going to be 3 to 4. I think that, rental increases definitely going to moderate, but once we digest a lot of the rental supply that's coming online over the next 12 months, there's going to be no real projects being built and you're going to see real re-acceleration. And like I said, on the good side, that's really like sort of the swing factor. And it's not just reshoring that's going to lead to higher structural prices. It's the lack of cheap labor, no longer out of China. Even Vietnam is getting more expensive with respect to labor. So that takes away that major contribution to very low prices. Just-in-time inventory definitely has been altered post-COVID. Now, technology is always going to be an inflation depressant. It's always disinflationary, but that's been the case since the history of time. So what I'm talking about is just a cyclical, stickier rate of inflation for the next couple of years that's not just going to magically go back to pre-COVID levels like COVID never happened. Now, there's also a big difference between 1 to 2% inflation and 3 to 4. 3 to 4 means that, you know, on the next economic downturn, the Fed's not going to be able to just do massive QE and cut rates back to zero. Central bankers have much less license to do as they choose when inflation is not low. And 3 to 4, historically, you can call it low, but it's not really low. It's still much higher than a trend that we saw in the last couple of decades that, again, enabled central banks to get so experimental with monetary policy.
Yeah, Peter, it's going to be interesting to see if the central banks can get it below that 2% threshold, because at 3 to 4%, it is a bit higher, a little bit stickier. Let me ask you a question, though, just following up on the labor side of things. We've seen a lot of companies with their employees striking right now, asking for higher wages. We've seen the airlines raise their wages about 40% and pass that along to consumers. We've seen UPS drivers making $170,000 a year now, and obviously they're going to pass along higher rates to the consumer. How much wage pressure is there going to be forcing inflation into the system, as you alluded to there, from all these companies where people want higher wages? Isn't that going to still push the inflation needle?
So inflation, I find, is more influential in driving higher wages than higher wages in itself driving higher prices, because the latter depends. If my cost of living goes up, yeah, I'm going to want higher wages. And usually what we're seeing in the examples you just gave, employees are getting it. Now, the thing about a lot of these strikes that are going on is, keep in mind, the contracts that are expiring, that expired for UPS, that are expiring from the UAW with the auto sector, is these contracts were struck before COVID. These contracts were struck before the inflation spike. So a lot of these unions are just basically playing catch up to the rest of the private sector. And in the U.S., private sector unions, not public, but private sector unions, only make up about 5% of the entire labor force. So a lot of these contracts are just catch up. But getting back to my original point is, yes, typically higher inflation leads to higher wages. And it depends on whether that increase in wages leads to further increases in prices. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it does not, when companies can improve productivity, they can cut other costs, where they don't need to raise prices to offset that. Now, if they can't do that, then yes, you will get a continued price increase to offset your wage pressures if you feel like you can get away with it. Now, if you can't, then that comes at the sacrifice of your profit margins. So, you know, that's sort of the nuance. Now, people throw on the Phillips curve, and I think a lot of people misunderstand what the Phillips curve is. You ask the average person, they'll think, well, yeah, higher wages leads to higher inflation. Or I should say a tight labor market leads to higher inflation. No, that wasn't the original theory. Original theory is just basic supply and demand. If you have a tight labor market, that leads to higher wages. Only sometimes, as I said, does that lead to higher overall inflation. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But people conflated it and said, okay, tight labor market leads to higher inflation. And it was only higher wage inflation did it lead to.
Interesting. So then moving forward here, Peter, can central banks do anything? Can anybody do anything to cause almost a deflation, or at least inflation, again, coming back down, deflating to a certain point, or are we simply stuck with these higher prices moving forward?
Well, you look at a chart of CPI going back since World War II, and it is pretty much the bottom left to the upper right. It is rare. Outside of a major recession, do you see even a tiny downtick in the cost of living? It is perpetually higher. And, you know, I stated earlier that it's typically driven by services. I mean, the front page of the Wall Street Journal today said that employers face a 6.5% increase in their health insurance costs for their employees. You had UPS and FedEx today talking about 6 to 7%, actually 5.9% to be exact, 2024 rate increases for what they charge their customers. So services inflation is always higher. It's just that swing factor of the goods that determine what sort of overall aggregate inflation level that you get.
Well, Peter, to that point on the good side, when we see oil up close to $90 today, as we look at the markets and energy price estimations that there could be triple digit oil next year in 2024, that is something that affects the consumer. That's something that affects the business cycle and freight and everything else, food production. So how does higher energy prices factor into the inflation on the good side?
Yeah, so that I'm glad that you got to oil, because I know inflation debate is complete without talking about that. And I think that is a major swing factor here, because I do believe we're going to see triple digit oil prices and much higher retail consumer product energy prices, whether it's gasoline or certainly jet fuel and so on. And that's going to really complicate the Fed's job. So I do think that that's a major swing factor. And you know, getting back to this inflation debate, you know, there's one thing to see a decline in the rate of inflation, but it's another thing to keep it down. So the Fed doesn't declare victory just because if inflation goes back to 2% for a couple months. It's keeping it there on a sustainable basis is the victorious thing, because once it gets to 2%, it can easily jump up again. And oil prices could be a swing factor in causing that, just as we saw in the 1970s or late 60s through the 70s, where you saw a jump in inflation, it fall back, it accelerated again, it fell back, and then it reaccelerated into the peak into, you know, late 70s, early 80s.
Peter, what about other commodities too? I know energy plays so much into it, but other commodities, we have heard the argument that commodities could go through a boom here. Broadly, would that then also impact the inflation narrative?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, it's really the focus of when we look at inflation from the commodity standpoint, it's really energy and food. You know, food prices being everything from row crops like corn, soybean, and wheat to, you know, stuff that we use every day like sugar and coffee and cocoa, where prices have gone up a lot. If you look at the CRB food index, you know, sort of an aggregate of all these different ag commodities, you know, it's come in well off its highs, for sure. So there's not necessarily as much of a risk in food prices right now, but they will be relative to energy. But, you know, the CRB food index is up pretty sharply from where it was just, you know, pre-COVID. Pre-COVID, I'm just looking at a chart right now. The CRB food price index the index itself was at 340. Today it's at 540. So now on a rate of change basis, it's slowed down. But on an absolute basis, you know, food and energy prices being where they are is going to be a continued pressure point and swing factor of note in overall inflation.
Peter, do you think it's possible that we could be re-entering what some were talking about last year, and that is a stagflationary period similar to the 1970s, as you alluded to, because we're going to have a little bit higher than they want inflation if we're near that 3%, 4% range, especially if we see a little uptick in inflation? I know that the GDP was revised downwards. It's still in the positive territory. Last year, we saw two quarters of negative GDP, but we're also seeing some wobbles under the surface of the labor markets, and we are seeing that high energy factor. It does remind people of the 70s and stagflation. Is that the kind of period that we're going into, and could that cause a recession in and of itself?
Yeah, I mean, it could. You know, the thing with, you know, the cost of living, a key part of that is where wages go along with that. And, you know, if you get a 3% rise in inflation, a 4% rise in inflation, but you get a similar rise in wages, then, you know, the average consumer is not necessarily falling behind. They're not gaining, but they're not falling behind. The problem with the U.S. economy, at least the last couple of years, is inflation ran much faster than wages. And now wages are beginning to catch up. So in the last couple of months, wage growth has been exceeding in inflation. Now in the aggregate level, where consumers sort of behave, because they don't, the consumer doesn't focus on rate of change. They look at the cumulative rise in their cost of living, and that's up dramatically. And it's going to really complicate things here. Now to your stagflation question or point is that relative to the 1970s, that was sort of a different, it was stagflation in its own different way, in the sense that we had high unemployment and high inflation. Here we actually had low unemployment and high inflation, but I think we're having a form of stagflation in that we're having a higher level of inflation, even though it's coming down, and just very modest economic growth, with the potential that, like I said earlier, inflation doesn't go down to 1-2% on a sustainable basis. It's more 3-4, and economic growth is pretty anemic, like 0-2%, which you can define as stagflation as well.
What does this mean for markets then, Peter? If inflation is going to stay high, maybe the Fed will, or other central banks too, will stay handcuffed. This whole bad news is good news for the markets, or good economic data is bad news for the markets. How does this trickle over into the broad financial markets in a longer term outlook?
Well, I think a big contributor to the rally in the stock market off the October 22 low was it coincided with both a peak in the dollar than a bottom in the stock market for the same reason, and that the Fed was finally slowing down the pace of their rate increases. They had 4 75 basis point rate increases in a row that ended right at the end of October, and they started to slow that down to the point where now they're pausing in between in hikes and maybe done for good. And we've been trained for so many years that you got to buy when the Fed's done, and or when the Fed cuts, you got to buy stocks. And I think everyone sort of got ahead of that. I think it's beginning to sort of seep into people's realization that just because the Fed is done doesn't mean we're really done with the monetary tightening, because just by keeping rates high for a while is its own form of continuous monetary tightening, because every day, every month, every year that goes by from here, rates stay high, somebody's debt is maturing and it needs to be refinanced, and it's going to be refinanced at a much higher rate than the debt, than the rate on the debt that's maturing. And then you have, of course, quantitative tightening that's going on with a lot of different central banks, and that's another continuous form of tightening. And Chicago Fed president and a voting member, Austin Goolsbee, said just recently that the conversation needs to switch from how much more to how long we stay this tight. Because you can be sure, Jay Powell, who's got a couple of years left on his term, he is not going to lose inflation again. He is focused on his legacy. He doesn't care about politics at this point. He's going to stay tight as long as he's convinced that inflation is going to not only go down, but stay down.
Well, Peter, I'd be curious to see how this translates over into your expectations for corporate earnings, because one of the things that's buoyed companies' earnings in the first and second quarter was that they were able to raise prices, even if they really didn't need to, under the guise of, hey, it's inflation, and that helped with their margins. And we saw that okay or only marginal earnings reports were punished, bad reports were just completely punished. And there is the concern from some economists that we're going to see an earnings recession as we get into the latter part of this year. What's your outlook on corporate earnings?
Well, we're already three quarters into an earnings recession, so we're there. Now expectations have improved for Q3 that they'll rebound, but unless the economy accelerates, I don't know how they're going to magically rebound. And I only see the potential for growth to further decelerate. As now, two areas of strength in the U.S. economy was the labor market and the auto sector. Auto sector, in terms of the inventory rebuild and catch up that that sector was making, well, that's sort of playing itself out. So the auto sector is really the last man standing in the industrial sector, and I think that's slowing down. We saw auto sales for the U.S. for August that were pretty soft relative to pre-2019 levels and had decelerated. And then the labor market, we're seeing a rate of deceleration in hiring. So if you don't get an acceleration in revenue growth, not sure where that earnings inflection moves higher. Now, for some companies, it'll be a mixed bag. You have relief on the supply chains, you have relief on the input cost side, but some other companies, they used inflation to drive stronger revenue. Inflation was a major driver of revenue growth the last couple of years. The U.S. Kenny Consumer Products Company, who had revenue growth of 10%, chances are price was 12 percentage points of that, and volume detracted maybe 200 basis points of that. So without that sort of pricing power, if inflation continues to decelerate, I'm not sure where that earnings growth is going to come from.
What other parts of the economy do we need to pay attention to then, Peter? You isolated a couple there, but anything else big picture that you think really does give people more of a heads up of what's coming?
Well, I think internally, after listening to a lot of retail conference calls over the past 3 weeks, the U.S. consumer, whether it's an upper-income consumer making over 100 grand or lower to middle-income making less than that, they're prioritizing spend. I mean, there is a clear focus on, I'm only buying what I need. I'm not also buying what I want. And I'm really got my eye on the U.S. consumer, because that's sort of been keeping things going. And at least on the leisure, hospitality, and travel side, that's been very strong. And now all of a sudden, we're seeing softening in airline fares. And I'm wondering whether that sort of that revenge travel has been satiated, and all of a sudden you're going to get a pullback there. And that was the one area of consumer spending strength. Now, on the flip side, the U.S. government is incentivizing hundreds of billions of dollars worth of spending on chips and anything green, which is going to be an economic boon to certain parts of the U.S. for anybody who's going to be building factories to make batteries and so on. So there are definitely a lot of cross currents in the economy. But overall, I think we still have a time to go to absorb this new interest rate world that is much higher than the world that we exited in 2021, I should say, when the rate hike started in early 2022.
Well, and Peter, just one more question, because there's a large part of our audience that follows the precious metals. It seems like in lieu of all these macro factors, whether it's the strength of the consumer, inflation, earnings from the companies, that there could be some wobbles in the time to come. And it seems like gold is holding up better than many expect it to and has for the last year or so. What's your outlook on the yellow metal in light of all these macro forces?
I mean, when you think about gold being, what, $100 from a record high? And central banks around the world have, outside of the Japanese, have notably raised interest rates, the Fed in particular, going from zero to 550 basis points in 18 months, and gold would hang in this well, I think is a pretty impressive performance. And also, you know, the dollar strength that we've seen. That strength was mostly beginning in the summer of 2021 that carried over into October 2022, but dollar strength nonetheless. And gold's traded really well in the face of that. So I think that says a lot. I think that reflects some pretty strong demand from central banks. I think we are still in, you know, we're sort of exiting this monetary fantasy land where these geniuses at these central banks sort of created out of thin air the concept of negative interest rates that make gold even more attractive. And while most of those negative yielding securities have gone into positive territory, you know, that kind of world still lingers in people's minds. And in many places, interest rates are still below the rate of inflation, giving us negative real rates. That makes gold pretty attractive.
All right, Peter. Thank you very much for your time. Always great hearing from you. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And I'm sure we'll chat sometime next month. So again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Always appreciate being on. See you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.